Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today we have two stories for you from the United States. The first one tells about poor children who are getting free food during the time when their schools are closed for the summer. Then we will hear about some unusual changes that are being made to one of this country's most famous musical plays. Let's get started with part one. In the United States, millions of children depend on schools for meals during the school day. Most schools are closed for 3 months over the summer, meaning a lot of these children could be getting less to eat. In the Washington, D.C. area, a nonprofit group has found a way to provide food to boys and girls over the summer months. The group brings meals to them in a converted school bus. Laura Juarez-Cruz and her three children live in a mobile home park in Northern Virginia. She says many of her neighbors have low-paying jobs or none at all.
Right now, there's a lot of people that don't work, and it's hard to, you know, have them kids at the house and asking for food. And
like more than 21 million students across the country, her children receive meals for free or at very small cost at school. When classes end, however, so do the meals. To reach youngsters like these in the D.C. area, the Capital Area Food Bank launched a feeding bus. The group operates the program in partnership with a local grocery store. The feeding bus started making trips to needy communities in June, when school ended.
Yeah, when they saw the bus coming, they were happy. they like fruits.
Cecilia Vergati is with the Capital Area Food Bank. She helped launch the program.
So we knew that there were pockets of poverty and there would be pockets of children that could really use this food. And so hence the bus idea was born.
To identify where the bus should visit, the food bank built what it calls a hunger map. It shows many neighborhoods that lack summer feeding programs. 16 million children belong to the families that are considered food insecure. Last year, the U.S. government fed more than 3 million such children. Many others were in need of services, like the food bank's bus. The federal summer food program has been feeding children since 1975. At first, its goal was to provide food for areas like summer camps and community center programs. In such places, about a third of the children receive free or reduced-priced meals during the school year. Audrey Rowe works for the United States Department of Agriculture, which directs the Federal Summer Food Service Program.
It wasn't created with enough flexibility to address the changes that may happen within the way the schools operated or the intentions of communities and how they provided programs.
She adds that fewer children are going hungry now because the agency has many more new partners. One of those partners is the Capital Area Food Bank. It has the ability to reach communities beyond the government program's target. It brings meals to housing developments and mobile home parks. 7-year-old Lucy Velasquez Castro lives in a mobile home park.
They make sure you eat a lot. It's so good. My favorite food is apple.
The program makes sure she has a large supply of apples and other healthy foods all summer long. You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The musicals of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein have been popular in American theaters for more than 50 years. In recent years, two of their shows, South Pacific and The King and I, returned to New York City theaters. The two received Tony Awards for excellence. Now, an experimental version of the first Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, Oklahoma, is being performed at Bard College in upstate New York. Bob Doty tells us more.
Oklahoma was a different kind of musical from the beginning. When the show opened on Broadway in 1943, critics thought it was unusual. Ted Chapin is the legal representative of the Rodgers and Hammerstein estates.
Even though today we take it for granted that all the pieces of a musical work with each other, it was a bit of a revelation then. The fact that every song had to do with character, that dance came out of the song after you couldn't sing it anymore, you had to dance it. All of those things, which today we almost take for granted, but before Oklahoma, it was sort of unheard of.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain.
On the surface, Oklahoma seems like a simple story about a young woman. She must decide whether to go to a party with a nice young cowboy or a dangerous, lonely farm worker. But there is a dark side to the story. The show is set at the turn of the 20th century, before Oklahoma became a state. At that time, the U.S. territory was a place of social and political unrest. Producer Gideon Lester says Rodgers and Hammerstein understood this.
There is no history of colonization or expansion or the building of nationhood that doesn't contain violence in it. And Oklahoma dramatizes that. Now, it does it in a way that is sunny and funny and full of beautiful music. And that juxtaposition makes that violence even more disquieting, I think.
And disquiet is just what director Daniel Fish wants to bring to the latest production of Oklahoma. To help theatergoers feel the show's conflicting emotions, he puts them close to the action. They sit at long tables on all four sides of the theater. The room is made to look like a community hall. For the music, there is no large orchestra, just a six-piece band with their instruments. And actors sometimes speak their lines while sitting in chairs.
Lots of things happen to folks. Sickness, or being poor and hungry even. Being old and afeard to die.
The part of the show in which Curly, the cowboy, faces Judd, the farmhand, is especially unsettling. Daniel Fish says Hammerstein described Judd's home in detail.
That it's dark, that it's the source of a kind of sexuality and a kind of unknown. And so, well, how do you do that in this space? Well, sometimes the dumb answer is the best answer is, well, what happened if we did the scene in the dark?
A fellow wouldn't feel very safe in here with you if he didn't know you. But I know you, Judd. In this country, there's two things you can do if you're a man. Live out of doors is one, and live in a hole is the other.
Damon Donohue plays Curly. He says the lack of lighting can have a big effect.
And it's amazing how uncomfortable a bit of darkness makes people, understandably, but it really changes the sort of spine in the room. You can really feel that.
Where the production may be most unusual is at its end. What had been an accidental death in the earlier productions becomes a cold-blooded murder. Daniel Fish says this makes a deliberate point.
It makes the community culpable, and I would argue that it probably makes the audience culpable as well.
And that, he says, gives them something to think about.
You know, it's an old story, but it's also a story that matters now in terms of issues of community, in terms of violence, in terms of how we create outsiders, and in terms of love.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
I'm Bob Doty.
And I got a beautiful feeling.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The dry conditions in California are good for people who like to swim in the Pacific Ocean. Because of the drought, there is less water runoff from cities into the ocean. As a result, the ocean water is cleaner. But pollution remains a problem in other areas, including popular beaches. Angelo Bellomo works for the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health.
When we have runoff from the urban environment, it could be carrying with it contamination due to animal waste, sewage overflows, and if those enter the beaches through the normal pipes that terminate in the ocean, you want to avoid contact with water during those periods.
He adds that people could become infected with a number of diseases from swimming in polluted ocean water. Public health officials are looking for a fast way to identify water quality levels along the California coast. Currently, they use laboratory tests. If the tests show the quality is poor, warning signs are placed along the coastline. But because lab workers need more than a day to test the water, the information on the sign can be outdated. Leslie Griffin works for an environmental group called Heal the Bay. She says the current warning system is not very helpful.
Right now, it takes 18 to 24 hours to get those water quality results. But we think that that's, you know, a little ridiculous because we want people to know the day of when they're going in the water whether or not they could be getting sick.
Until lab tests can be completed faster, researchers in California are using what they call a predictive modeling system. The system makes an educated guess about water quality. Heal the Bay says the system can make a prediction about water quality in as little as 15 minutes. Researchers use computers to gather information about the environment. The data includes wind speed and direction, information about ocean waves, and recent bacterial contamination. Because each beach is different, computer models are created for each one. The researchers then use the data to predict the possible quality of the water that day. The process is called noun casting. Angelo Bellomo says the predictive modeling system looks promising.
We think that the modeling that we've seen so far is generally more accurate than the predictions or than the testing that we're doing. And the reason for that is that even though it's a model and it's predicting water quality, it's more timely.
Hong Kong and the American state of Ohio have similar methods of predicting water quality. And that's the Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
America at its best matches a commitment to principle with a concern for civility.
In recent weeks, we talked about the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. This week in our series, we look at domestic policy during the first term of President George W. Bush. Bush, the Republican nominee, defeated Vice President Al Gore, the Democratic candidate, in the presidential election of 2000. A dispute over the ballot count in Florida delayed the declaration of a winner and only added to political divisions in the country. The results in Florida were extremely close. 5 weeks passed as courts considered the issues. Finally, a conservative majority on the United States Supreme Court settled the matter. George Bush was to be president. Bush gave his inaugural speech on January 20th, 2001.
With a simple oath, we affirm old traditions and make new beginnings. As I begin, I thank President Clinton for his service to our nation. And I thank Vice President Gore for a contest conducted with spirit and ended with grace.
The new president spoke of American ideals.
The grandest of these ideals is an unfolding American promise that everyone belongs, that everyone deserves a chance, that no insignificant person was ever born.
And he called on Americans to care for and respect each other.
Today we affirm a new commitment to live out our nation's promise through civility, courage, compassion, and character. America at its best matches a commitment to principle with a concern for civility. A civil society demands from each of us goodwill and respect, fair dealing, and forgiveness.
Soon after his inauguration, President Bush established the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. The goal was to fight problems like homelessness and drug abuse with the help of social agencies connected to religious groups. Critics argued that this could violate the separation of religion and government under the United States Constitution. But the president said the agencies would provide shelter and food, not Bibles. President Bush took several actions on the environment during his first term, two of which brought strong protests from environmentalists. In March 2001, he made the decision to reject the Kyoto Protocol. That international treaty sought reductions in the release of carbon dioxide and other industrial gases blamed for trapping heat in the atmosphere. Negotiators approved the treaty in Kyoto, Japan, at the end of 1997, to show their concern about climate change. Vice President Gore later signed the Kyoto Protocol for the United States. But President Bill Clinton never sent it to the Senate for its required approval. The treaty faced enough opposition in the Senate that it might have been defeated. President Bush decided to unsign the treaty. He said he did not want to put the United States at a competitive disadvantage with big developing countries like China and India. Those countries would not have been required to cut the large amounts of greenhouse gases they were producing. Bush said the agreement was unfair and would harm American industry at a time when the economy was weakening. Critics said the president's decision would harm the environment and set a bad example for the world. Another environmental issue concerned exploring for oil and natural gas. The president supported a measure to allow drilling in a wildlife refuge in the state of Alaska. He said doing so would reduce American dependence on foreign oil. Opponents argued that it would destroy wildlife in some of America's most beautiful natural surroundings. In the end, the environmentalists won. Congress did not approve the drilling.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
One of President Bush's major domestic goals was improving America's public education system.
Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell.
In January 2002, he signed legislation passed by Congress called the No Child Left Behind Act.
We owe the children of America a good education, and today begins a new era. A new time in public education in our country. As of this hour, America's schools will be on a new path of reform and a new path of results.
The law increased the role of the federal government in an area where Americans have traditionally defended local control, public education. No Child Left Behind had several goals. To help poor and minority students improve their performance, to provide choices for parents with students in low-performing schools, and to increase money for schools in low-income areas. The law required all students in grades 3 through 8 to be tested every year in reading and math. It held schools responsible for showing that all students were making progress based on standards chosen by the states themselves. No Child Left Behind had many supporters, but critics said the expectations were unreasonable and that teachers might just teach to the test. Another major piece of legislation dealt with health care for older Americans. President Bush wanted to extend Medicare, the nation's health insurance program, for people 65 and older.
For nearly four decades, Medicare has been the binding commitment of a caring society. We must renew that commitment by providing our seniors with the preventative care and new medicines that are transforming health care in our country. We must protect seniors from high medical costs that can rob them of their savings. And we must place patients and their doctors at the center of every health care decision. My goal is to give seniors more choices and better benefits under Medicare, including a long-awaited prescription drug benefit.
In 2003, he signed a law to help 40 million older Americans pay for their medicine. On another issue, he banned federal funding for research on any new stem cells taken from human embryos. But he agreed to allow the first federal spending on research on existing lines of embryonic stem cells. Such cells interest some medical researchers because they can grow into different kinds of cells. But opponents object for moral and religious reasons, to destroying embryos for the purpose of harvesting stem cells. George Bush promised to cut taxes for Americans. In 2001, he signed a bill passed by Congress calling for more than $1 trillion in tax reductions over time. The president said the economy would improve if people had more money to spend. In 2003, Congress passed $350 billion in additional tax reductions. That was less than half of what the president had proposed. In 2002, President Bush signed a law that increased punishments for financial dishonesty by companies. The new law also established an independent group to oversee the accounting industry. The action came after several major companies failed, including, in 2001, Enron.
I've got money wherever I go. I see money beginning to grow.
Enron had grown into America's leading energy company.
In the canyons of downtown Houston, home to the country's energy giants, a sense of gloom surrounds this one. Only months ago, it was the mightiest of them all. Now Enron answers the phone with this recorded message.
On December 2nd, Enron filed under Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code, thus commencing proceedings to stabilize our financial situation.
It was at that time the largest bankruptcy in American history. 10,000 people lost their jobs. Some Enron investors lost all their money in the failure. Former employees lost the retirement benefits they needed to live on. Some top Enron officials were found to have used dishonest accounting methods to hide financial problems from investors. Enron's troubles also involved two large banks, Chase and Citigroup, and a big financial company, Merrill Lynch.
Enron couldn't have engaged in the deceptions it did without the help from a major financial institution. Merrill Lynch assisted Enron in cooking its books by pretending to purchase an existing Enron asset when it was really engaged in a loan.
Senator Carl Levin led a hearing into accounting and consulting practices and how they benefited Enron. Those actions included inflating the value of the company's stock. The collapse of Enron was followed by a series of other corporate failures linked to dishonest accounting methods. November 2, 2004 was Election Day. 4 years earlier, George W. Bush had been elected in one of the closest races in American history. Now he would have another chance to test his popularity with the American people. The 2004 election will be our story next week. You can find our series online, with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.